Not many guys in the business had maybe the most hallowed moniker out there of Nature Boy. There was Buddy Rogers back in the 50s and 60s. Subsequently, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, Ric Flair, a couple of years after Ric Flair. This next gentleman, one of the few to wear that title and to wear it proudly, of Nature Boy, Buddy Landell. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the FDH Lounge, sir. How are you tonight?
Hello?
Buddy. Buddy, welcome to the FDH Lounge. Yeah. How are you? Buddy?
Man, I can barely hear you, man. I'm riding with my convertible top down. I can't hear nothing.
Okay. All right. We'll do better.
I can hear you now.
Gotcha. Okay, buddy. We'll try to rectify.
Let me pull over here and put my top up, okay?
Okay. All right. Buddy Landell.
Yeah, let me pull up here a little bit so I don't get hit in the ass.
Buddy Landell driving in the convertible top down. The man truly is living the gimmick of the Nature Boy.
It's not just a convertible, brother. It's a convertible Porsche.
Nice. Nice. You are living the gimmick, sir. I take my hat off to you. That's outstanding. We would expect the Nature Boy to be driving such a fine vehicle. That's outstanding.
Yeah. Well, you know, God's been good to me, man. I've had above average opportunities in my life, and I've taken advantage of them. Man, it's wonderful to be on y'all's show tonight. I tell you, I've been looking forward to this all day.
It's a pleasure to have you on, buddy. It really is. I want to start by looking at your career when you broke in, and it's notable to me on your homepage, you have a tribute on there to your good friend, the Junkyard Dog. He obviously was a big influence when you started your career. And again, one of the greatest regional draws in the history of the business. And as I understand it, just a wonderful guy.
He was, you know, and like I've told other people, you know, it was my chance to see, you know, up close and personal and firsthand, you know, what an actual superstar was. I mean, in a regional territory, you know, where... I mean, he was a demigod, man. I mean, he was just he was a god with a small g.
Yeah, he.
You know, I mean, Louisiana was like 60-70% black, and he was just like, he's the only guy that only black man I ever knew that could go to a Ku Klux Klan rally and sign autograph and sell autograph pictures. He was fantastic, man. It was the short time that you know, he actually got to, my youngest daughter got to meet him right before he passed away, but my wife knew him, you know, from the time I did. Now I'm just so glad that my family got to meet him, you know. I miss him dearly.
Well, buddy, God bless you for putting that tribute up on your page there.
I write poetry too, and I actually wrote that poem just minutes after, you know, I found out he was gone, and I appreciate you saying that because that, you know, we can talk about my wrestling career all night, but that's something that's really. Really special to me, and I really appreciate you bringing that up first.
Well, that's amazing too. That it's, as I look at the poetry there, that it's that raw, that it just poured out of you. That's amazing that you were able to come up with something. You had the presence when you got that horrible, horrible news. But yeah, you've had a really, really interesting career. The places you've gone, the things that you've done. In terms of a timeline, let me ask you this question because I've heard disputed things on this. I want to get it from you.
Yeah, well, I've got a photographic memory. Some people say that I've got a selective memory, but I've got a photographic memory. You want to know something? Give me an angle, and I'll give you the year and territory.
Buddy, this one's going to be really easy for you because it's so big in your career. I'm somebody that as a kid, I start, and here's the funny thing too. When I was a teenager watching wrestling, I didn't realize how close in age you were at the time. I didn't realize how young you were. You were not that much older than me, but I was a kid living in the Midwest, started watching you when you came to Crockett in 85 because I was able to watch it on the Superstation. Did you have the Nature Boy moniker before Crockett?
No, I didn't. None.
Okay. Interesting. Because Ric Flair in his book, he sort of...
Well, the girls used to call me TJJ, tight Jordache jeans, but other than that, no.
Okay. Well, that's interesting, because I want to ask if there was anything you picked up on the time politically. I was surprised to read in Ric Flair's book that he sort of seemed a little threatened by that, and he said, "Yeah, Dusty Rhodes, you notice he wasn't calling anybody else the American Dream," and that he sort
of... Rick's got a selective memory, too. Rick is the one that wanted me. In 1984, Dory Funk was actually booking Crockett,
uh-huh.
and the territory was on its ass. I mean, they were doing horrible, horrible business. As a matter of fact, when Arn Anderson and I started February the 4th, 1985, and our first road trip was with Black Bart, and Black Bart looked at both of us and said, "Boys, get ready for some long trips and some $300 weeks." And me and Arn in unison at the same time said, "We'll only get one $300 paycheck. Now, by God, we'll go back where we come from." You know, because we were making a bunch of money for Watts, respectively, and him down in Pensacola for Fuller. But Flair has a selective memory. He was the one that wanted me to come in and do the Nature Boy angle to begin with. Besides, Flair acts like I stole the name from him. Does he forget that Buddy Rogers was the original Nature Boy and he gave the name to Rick? I mean...
Exactly. Well, and thanks for setting the record straight on that. The impression I got from the book was that he seemed to more be blaming that on Dusty as opposed to you. But it's a thing where...
Yeah.
Ultimately, when Flair, later in 85, when they set up the beginnings of the Four Horsemen at that point in time,
right.
that sort of ended like it was going to short-circuit it because you were working heel at the same time, too. So,
I short-circuited that whole big angle that Dusty had laid out for months, you know, and people want to call into question, you know, was I going to be the world champion? Was I actually going to get the belt? I always defer back to Dusty because, you know, only Dusty will be able to tell. You know, whether I'm lying or I'm telling the truth. So I always defer that question back to him inevitably. But that being said, Flair and I broke Elvis's attendance record in the Dorton Arena, Raleigh, North Carolina. Set records every time that we worked together. Here I am, selling out. Who would have been the logical choice to drop the belt on for a week like Tommy Rich or a month like somebody else or for a little bit longer period, you know? So it's not a stretch of the imagination to take the guy that Ric Flair is selling out with to drop the belt on for a month or two or whatever the case may be.
Exactly.
You know, people always want to discount, you know, my credibility, and for a long time I never had a response, and now my response is, ain't kiss my ass. It doesn't matter to me. 48 years old, I don't care what they think anymore. And there was a guy that wrote an article, the title of the article was The Greatest Story Never Told, and it's exactly about this angle that never happened, that was going to happen. If that angle would have happened, there was no doubt an angle was going to happen. And when Dusty fired me, was right after that, was when the Four Horsemen were originated. Mm-hmm. And his story was, what happens if Buddy didn't mess up on drugs and stuff and still worked there? The Four Horsemen would have never been.
Yeah.
They would have never, wouldn't have been a need for a Four Horsemen because everybody would have been in their respective angles. So that's another thing that people don't think about.
That's true.
So
that's true. Oh, this is
the
great.
People that love the Four Horsemen, instead of knocking me, they can just, say thank you, buddy, and move on.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. This is great stuff, really inside stuff here. I'd like to get your impression of two people you worked with very strongly in different capacities, two of our favorite guests previously from the history of the show, James J. Dillon, who, of course, was your manager in 85 during that point in time, and then
right.
also Jim Crockett, who Jim Cornette, who, of course, you worked
right.
for in Smoky Mountain in the 90s.
Right. There's nobody that I hold in higher esteem than those two men. I love them both silly, and they're great, wonderful minds. I mean, Jimmy Cornette, been my best friend, man, since 1980, and I mean, we've been everywhere together, made money together, we've slept, ate, and bled together, been in riots together, and just a guy that is a definite asset to the business. J.J. Dillon was like an older brother to me, and he, would put me under his wing and just like the junkyard dog and try to teach me about, different aspects of the business, angles, the psychology, and things like that. So I'm a much better person and worker because of the two of them. Nothing but nice things to say.
Very well said. Yeah, they're both. Yeah, I don't know them nearly as well as you do, but both really impressive gentlemen to me. I have to say.
And, now, I don't know what they had to say about me, but it wouldn't change my opinion nonetheless. So.
Well. No,
I think they're wonderful people.
Well, JJ doesn't seem like he badmouths anybody. So, I think he likes you from what we could tell. And, Jim Cornette, yeah, I mean, he said good things about you when he was on the show as well. One of the things I said is, when we were introducing you is that it's very refreshing to have you on because you are what I would consider to be a life success story, in a business that, I mean, all you got to do is look at the headlines and look at the guys of your generation and some of the guys that came along subsequently. A lot of sad stories coming through the business here. You, it seems to be about positivity, what you've been able to do. Now getting this film career off the ground, now to the extent that I understand you're going to be in a film with Hilary Swank even.
I don't know who put that up on my Wikipedia page, but that's non-true.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I apologize for that. I don't keep up with that Wikipedia and all of that stuff. And there's two MySpace accounts with Buddy Landon. Neither one of those are mine. I'm on Facebook, and that is actually me. But other than that, I'd love to sit here and tell you that I was getting ready to be in a movie with Hilary Swank.
Okay.
And share the love with her, but that's a non-truth.
I feel bad that our research ran into that there, but you did. I'm going to guess that it's not a complete embellishment because it did refer to another movie in 1996 as well. So is that one true?
Oh yeah, I was actually in a Box of Moonlight with John Turturro and Sam Rockwell. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's interesting.
I played a character called Uncle Samson.
Oh, okay. Well, whoever defaced the Wikipedia page put Sam Rockwell in the Hilary Swank movie with you in 2009. So they just
give it a little cred, right?
They just moved the pieces around a little bit. What was that like? Yeah, how did you get that opportunity? How'd that come about?
The people that filmed that movie actually came to Johnson City to watch me wrestle. Well, actually, I'll take that back. They came to Johnson City to cast the character, and after they saw me wrestle, they picked me to be in the movie. So I was very fortunate.
Oh, that's tremendous.
In a radio interview.
That's tremendous. So. And I know that, and you touched on it briefly as far as, back at the time in Crockett there and the drugs and everything like that. As far as how you've come out the other side, with your commitment that you've had, to God since then. Talk about what you've been doing. I think you've been spreading a very good, very positive message. We always love that on this show. Talk about what you've been doing, propagating that in the last several years.
Well, I mean, I'm not out here pontificating to wear it out. I mean, I lived that life. It's over with. It's in my past. I mean, next question. I just try to, I try to encourage people by staying alive, man. I mean, people, I actually went up in the WWF and, I wrestled Bret Hart there for the world title, one of my last appearances up there. And the guy said, I lost a bunch of money on you. They had a death pool on who was going to die next. And, I was on top of the list. And some of the guys were coming up bitching at me about, staying alive. I said, man, I'm so sorry. I'd like to help you out. But, I had my grandson, he's almost 6 years old, and that really had a major impact on my life that, I wanted to stay around and raise him. I'm actually in the best shape I've been in probably since, and looked the best I've looked since probably 95 in Smoky Mountain. I just decided to, to lose 80 pounds, get back in shape, and, who knows? I mean, I stay in contact with Terry Taylor and, Ric Flair and I text each other once or twice a week, and I actually texted him about a week and a half ago and said, hey, Nate, you think we got one more sellout in us? So you never know what's going to happen or who's going to call or where I'm going to show up at. But, I just try to encourage the young guys to not go down the same path, that we did.
Oh, yeah. That's funny you mentioned that about Flair. I mean, you sure would make I hate to blow any chance of it by speculating here. You sure would make an interesting mystery partner for Hogan on a Monday night, wouldn't you?
Well, I would love to tease you and say, you never know, but I haven't got the phone call yet. But I would love the opportunity to I'd love the opportunity to do that. I really would. On a lot of levels that, you know, vindication being number one, you know, coming back from abject, not poverty, but just abuse in my life, abject abuse, and then, you know, a success story. Everybody likes a success story.
Yeah.
You know, but my thing is, I've been married almost 29 years. I stayed married through my whole marriage, I mean, through my whole career, which is another, you know, something you don't hear a lot of, you know, in wrestling. I've been married almost 29 years, and I love my wife. She loves me, and she's, you know, held my hand through this whole thing and never gave up on me. And so my family stayed intact. So, you know, that's a... I'm a lot further ahead than a lot of guys just in that one area. You know, I'm really blessed.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing more important than that. There's nothing more important than, you know, being alive and having a good life and everything like that. Along the lines
right.
of somebody who was not, unfortunately, so blessed in that regard, a recent passing from the scene in wrestling here. I don't know how much you overlapped with him in Mid-South. I think there was at least a little bit. Steve Dr. Death Williams, recent cancer victim here. Talk about your memories of him.
Steve and I, they actually interviewed me for his autobiography. I trained Steve and had his first match. And Steve actually, I'd defer you back to his book. I mean, that's, you know, that's what's in his book. His own autobiography. So I was real close with Steve. So was my wife, and it was sad the way that happened.
That my gosh, I tell you what, my compliments to you. I didn't know that you'd trained him. I always thought that you know how great he was and underutilized and everything like that. Boy, they really didn't do much with him after the UWF merger in 87, 88 like they could have. My God,
right.
I didn't know you.
Yeah.
My compliments to you, sir, for training such another great professional.
Well, it was me mainly getting him started, and he had help from a lot of other guys like Ted DiBiase, Bill Watts. But the main thing is, I mean, my goodness, I mean, look at all the talent that he. You know, got to start out with the Duggins, the Butch Reeves, the Terry Taylors. I mean, everybody was in Mid-South in 84, 85, you know. So, you know, he had the talent to work with. He was definitely a talented definitely a talented man.
Yeah, raw materials, definitely. When you look at what a great collegiate wrestler that he was.
Right.
Buddy, we always like to give our guests a chance to plug whatever they got going on right now. I know that you've been back out there this year because you mentioned about dropping all the weight and wrestling some matches, so you've kind of dipped your toe
right.
in the water a little bit there. But I got to believe that's probably just the tip of the iceberg of what you got
well,
going
you know,
on right
I'm
now.
Well, you know, what I'm doing is chance favors a prepared mind, and so I prepared myself for, you know, a possible phone call. I mean, I wish I had something to plug, man. I'm just plugging along at life. I mean, I feel fantastic. I mean, just had my blood pressure is 120 over 80. My blood sugar is 102. I mean, I'm just healthy as a horse, and just I feel like $1 million. I'm a blessed man, and y'all, your listeners, if they'll say a prayer for me, that the Lord will just bless me and give me good health and bless my marriage and give me favor with. You know, whoever I meet, I'll be a happy man if they can do that for me.
We'll do that, sir. Well, we definitely will. I tell you what, the only flaw as I see it with you going to TNA, as I look at that show on Monday nights, you're probably still
yeah.
a little young for them, buddy. The median age there seems to be 55, 60 with the guys that they're pushing.
Well, you know, here's the bitch to the whole thing, okay?
Uh-huh.
Herein lies the rub. They've got a new law out now that if you hit anybody over 60 years old in the state of Florida, it's actually a felony. So how can I work with Flair?
Nice.
Well, there's three things that is a prerequisite to be the Nature Boy. You have to be under 60. You can't be on Social Security, and you got to have a full head of hair. I love Flair, but hey, strike three, you're out, and the Nature Boy Buddy Landell's back.
Yeah, by those standards, we only have one of those still walking around, and we're talking to them here tonight. So,
I appreciate so much you having me on. I've had a blast. You call me back anytime, and I just love this.
You anticipated perfectly. I was going to ask you if we could. A pleasure talking to you, buddy. I heard you were one
God
of the nicest
you.
Guys in the business, and you proved it here tonight. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much. Call me back, okay?
We will. I want to get
All
you
right,
back
God
on.
Bless.
We'll hold you to that. Thanks, buddy. The great,
All right. Take
the great
care.
Nature
Bye-bye.
Boy. Buddy Wendell, everybody. Our pleasure to have him on the FDH Lounge here tonight. A true original. And you heard some things here tonight, some pieces of history that I dare say have not gotten out previously, at least into the popular understanding of wrestling as we know it. Where that angle might have gone back in 85 there. He confirmed what Ric Flair said in his book, that he was not the Nature Boy Buddy Landell before going to Crockett in 85. But as far as, you know, any type of power play between Flair and Rhodes, I think he disputes that that's the case, and that they were just going after. And just from me looking at it from the outside, Buddy Landell's account of that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's Nature Boy versus Nature Boy. The business is all about that kind of stuff. Who's the real Nature Boy? That's what pro wrestling's all about. So for Ric Flair, in his book, indicating they felt a little bit threatened by it, or he thought Dusty Rhodes used it as a political wedge against him, I just, in my own opinion, that doesn't sound as likely. But again, I wasn't there. But I'm just saying, Buddy Landell's account seems to make very good sense to me. Didn't realize he trained Dr. Steve Williams. Hadn't read his book. I know Steve Cervello of the New York Bureau didn't know that either, based on his reaction from the IM here. He just wanted me to ask. He reminded me to ask him about Dr. Death. Didn't realize Buddy Landell trained him. So that just opened up a whole other line for him to talk about there. Some great guys and great wrestlers, great professional wrestlers that he knew and had bonds with, who unfortunately are no longer with us. Junkyard Dog, Steve Dr. Death Williams, some of the absolute greats from the Mid-South Circuit in the 80s. And that thing about Junkyard Dog is the only guy that could go to a Klan meeting and sign autographs. That, I'll tell you what, I mean, hyperbole, but it always struck me. I mean, the Louisiana of the early 80s, okay, I don't think was as evolved as it is now. I mean, it's a work in progress. I mean, you're talking about halfway along the line historically between Jim Crow and where it is now. And Junkyard Dog was over like you wouldn't believe there. And I think it crossed all barriers as far as who he was over with. So, you know, Buddy Landell making a joke about that, but I think the truth is pretty close to reality on that. That, you know, a lot of people who, you know, if Junkyard Dog was walking down the street and they didn't know who he was and, you know, wouldn't have liked him just, you know, for pretty stupid reasons, it then becomes, oh my God, Junkyard Dog, I'm a big fan of his. You know, it's just one of those weird things. Who would ever believed it? Pro wrestling helping to open people's minds. Pro wrestling helping to broaden people's perspectives. That's that's not necessarily the most likely thing. I don't think in any sociology classes that's what they were telling us. Huh, Walter, that pro wrestling was a difference maker in that way?
Might be the least likely thing.
But I'm telling you, man, it always just struck me at the time that it was weird because the people down there was a lot of serious effing rednecks down there. And everybody was like, we love Junkyard Dog. We always like, wow. You know, like today you could look at that and it wouldn't be necessarily that weird. But back in like the early 80s still, I don't think it was as evolved as it is now. I don't know. So that's, you know, I mean, that line about the Klan was hilarious. But again, there's an underlying truth to that. I mean, as far as, you know, hey, who knows? I mean, you know, it probably did broaden some people's perspectives. And, you know, if it caused anybody to look at Junkyard Dog, you know, as just a human being and, you know, to where race didn't come into it, then, hey, whatever. You know, pro wrestling for once, and I'm the first to admit how many stereotypes pro wrestling has pandered to, pro wrestling for once apparently helped bring people together. Who would have figured, and I agree, Walter, not the most likely thing in the world. You know, but that's, you know, for once, I guess the business got it right and wasn't just, you know, a pandering form of entertainment. But, you know, that part of it there, that was just funny when he said that.